Weeks after family members report a young woman is missing, investigators find a ring of keys in her car. One key has seemingly random numbers and letters stamped on it. Will this code be able to lead detectives to solve the disappearance of a vibrant young woman?
I'm Tyler J. Thomas.
I'm Jeff Moss.
And I'm Tim Coleman. Together, we will explore and discuss these events from the perspective of over 30 years of combined locksmith and door hardware experience. This is The Three Tumblers. Now, Keys to Murder, the Tamika Houston story.
It was a hot, muggy 91 degrees in Spartanburg, South Carolina, on June 2, 2004. As the sun began to set on that Wednesday evening, 24-year-old nursing student Tamika Houston pulled into the parking lot of the Fremont School Apartments. She got out, walked up the steps of the old building, and went to apartment 215 to see the guy she had been dating. 25-year-old Christopher Hampton let her inside and they began to chat when Tamika noticed that he was ironing clothes that he usually wore to go out on the town. When she confronted him, Christopher got angry and told Tamika he was going out with another girl. Betrayed and hurt, Tamika starts yelling and a full-out argument ensues. In a fit of anger, rage, and malice, Christopher grabbed the steam iron and hit Tamika in the head so hard it killed her instantly. A petite, free-spirited young woman who lived her life independently now lay dead in a closet. The only person who knew where she was the man that murdered her.
So I think we've all had a situation where someone we are dating cheated on us. And it is very hurtful, and it does make you angry. But just to strike someone down, it's horrible. It's horrendous to think that somebody would take that anger out just for being caught. It's just completely senseless. In my experience as a police officer, I've worked a lot of places like the Fremont Street Apartments when I was doing community policing. It's kind of like you think. There are a mix of people there. Some people are there because they can't afford anywhere else. And some people are there because the rent is low. And I think that Hampton was there because the rent was low and he could spend money on other things.
Yeah, and it sounds like it was a crime of passion, as they call it. It wasn't something that was planned. But that's got to be a hell of a way to go. Getting hit in the head with fire. But definitely sounds like, you know, like you said, low income. It was a school that was converted into apartments. I know they've had some buildings here that were called, you know, such and such classroom apartments. I don't think many of them exist anymore, but, you know, it was probably a subsidized type building, you know, maybe not to the level of housing projects, but something, you know, people who didn't have a lot of money rent a room.
Just minutes after convicted bank robber Christopher Lamont Hampton had savagely murdered Tamika Houston and hid her body in a closet, his date for the evening knocked on his door. As the 15-year-old girl walked into Christopher's bedroom, she saw a reddish-brown stain on the carpet and that the chest of drawers was pulled in front of the closet door. After the girl left, Hampton borrowed a friend's car and went to a local Walmart where he purchased a shovel, then drove back to his apartment and moved Tamika's body. He drove to a wooded area near an industrial park in the nearby town of Duncan, where he buried her in a shallow grave off of Tiger River Drive. After getting back to the Fremont School Apartments, Hampton took Tamika's car, a black 1991 Honda CRX, and drove it to a different apartment complex nearby. even though he took great care to wipe away his fingerprints, he dropped his own set of keys in the floorboard by accident. That accident would be his undoing.
Investigators only found partial prints too. So besides those, and the vehicle dropped in a random location and a set of keys, that's pretty much all they had to work with. But as an avid viewer of Forensic Files, Dateline 2020, it nearly always just takes one slip up for the investigators to get rolling on solving a case. They need one place to start, and if you give them that, they can do a tremendous amount of work as far as connecting it with other relevant pieces. And if they don't, as is the case with cold cases, any evidence and connections they find can eventually be paired with evidence and previous connections that present themselves down the road. So they've already started pretty well, if you want to call it that. They've got a good bit of evidence to work with right here and now.
Yeah, and I think that it was, like you said, you know, this was, you know, an easy break for them. It wasn't like huge months-long discovery. The guy left something that was easy to figure out who it was. It wasn't, didn't put his name on the keys, but he did something stupid. They caught a break, and it was able to help speed their investigation along. It wasn't like, you know, they cracked a big case to do this.
Criminals always make mistakes. They leave behind partial prints. They leave behind palm prints. They leave all sorts of trace evidence, or they put the mask on after they walk into the store to rob it. Whatever the mistake may be, it seems really minor then, but it does lead to their undoing. And people who think that, oh, it's suspicious that there was only one tiny partial fingerprint in this car, in Tamika's car, it's actually more common than what you might think. And unless if you are in a place, in a vehicle, in a building, very often, you're not going to leave a good full fingerprint as we think of it, like we see on television. What we see on television just isn't real. Even documentary shows will say a lot of times this is a partial print. Keys, as we're about to hear, were the biggest clue that investigators got. Partial print didn't really matter and didn't give them that much to go on.
Tamika Antoinette Houston was a very independent woman, according to her friends and family. After spending an entire day in line for an audition on American Idol, she realized how hard it was to break into the music industry, which had been a passion of hers since childhood. The Washington, D.C. native had moved to Spartanburg on her own and made the decision to become a nurse. In order to pay tuition for nursing school, the 4-foot, 11-inch tall woman with an infectious smile worked as a waitress at a local Cracker Barrel restaurant. Tamika's life was not without struggles, however. Her relationship with ex-boyfriend Terrence Moss had turned violent one night when, during an argument, he punched her. According to Moss, he immediately asked for her forgiveness and moved out. Tamika filed assault charges against Moss and was due to go to court just 2 weeks after she was killed. Living alone, Tamika was able to experience the independence and love of life she was known for. This included caring for her pit bull, Macy. The dog was the true love of her life and was expecting puppies soon. On June 14th, Rebecca Howard, Tamika's aunt, was becoming increasingly concerned after not hearing from her niece in almost 2 weeks. She called the Spartanburg Department of Public Safety from her home in Florida and asked that they go and check on Tamika. When police officers arrived, they found that Tamika's car was gone and all the doors were shut and locked. However, they were able to make entry through an unlocked window. Inside, they found Macy on the verge of starvation, and only one newborn puppy still alive. Upon learning that Tamika would never abandon her beloved dog, police knew that something had happened to her. They sent out an alert for police agencies to be on the lookout for Tamika's car, and Rebecca Howard and Tamika's parents all came to Spartanburg to help in the search. In the week after Tamika was reported missing, friends and family handed out and posted flyers with her picture and description all over the city of Spartanburg and the surrounding areas. On June 20th, a resident of the Luvinia D. Barksdale Apartments called investigators and told them that a black Honda CRX had been parked in the same space for nearly 3 weeks. When investigators arrived, they immediately confirmed the car belonged to Tamika Houston. In the front passenger's floorboard, they found a ring of keys. One of the keys had been stamped with the code AA14.
In 2004, when this happened, texting was a thing, but it wasn't as commonplace as it was 10 years later, or even now 20 years later. So the constant communications that we have today back then just didn't really exist. And I can say that I live by myself and I am very independent, and it's good to have a friend or family member who would notice that you're missing. I don't live near any of my family members, and basically you guys, Jeff and Tyler, are the two who would probably first notice if something did happen to me. Hopefully the people I work with as well. So for Tamika's aunt to realize that something was amiss, that set this whole case in motion. I don't think anybody around would have noticed that she was gone.
Yeah, and you know, we're in the age of the instant communication, and we can remember when people had pagers, I'm sure, and you know, payphones and things like that, where you had to make an effort to call somebody and check in and things like that. But I think this car is another big break that was sort of put in their lap, that, you know, just was sitting there for 3 weeks. You know, I think most people would notice a car a lot sooner than 3 weeks, something being out of place. We've had cars sit in the parking lot at our shop for a while. They tow them in short order, so something sitting for 3 weeks would probably not happen. So from my standpoint, it's like, why didn't somebody say something sooner? Car is going to probably start to get flat tires or something sooner than 3 weeks. I don't know. If somebody had never seen that car there before, you would think that they would say something.
Yeah, I can appreciate the concerned citizen or those that are paying attention to the local news as far as seeing what's going on and maybe figuring out, hey, something may be amiss around me. Let me pay attention. And if I do say something, let me say something. I normally would have not ever have been this kind of person, but now as I'm getting older, I am watching the local news every day. And when something happens in or around my town, my ears kind of perk up and I'm like, okay, let me be on the lookout. So, I mean, it's awesome that number one, the community is paying attention and willing to help. And then number two, that they are willing to help local investigators solve this crime. But at the end of the day, her family, her friends need some sort of conclusion to this. They need to find out what happened to her, and whoever did whatever happened to her needs to be brought to justice.
With only the ring of keys and a partial fingerprint as clues, detectives with the Spartanburg Department of Public Safety didn't have much to go on. After finding no matches to the partial print and aphis, cops started trying to track down the keys. On the ring were two keys to a 1980s model Ford vehicle. Two keys that are common for file cabinets, utility panels, and lockboxes. And one of the most common residential keys in the United States, the Schlage SC1. Schlage keys are used throughout the country for both residential and commercial applications. The design has been around for decades, and was out of patent long ago, allowing other manufacturers to use the key specifications in cheaper locks. But cops aren't locksmiths, and if they were, they would know that this key could go to almost any lock in the area. When detectives find that the key won't even go into the locks on Tamika's house, they know they have a clue in their hands. While there is no name or phone number on the key, the stamped AA14 is the next clue in their investigation. There are over a dozen locksmith shops in the Spartanburg area, and even more locksmiths who are mobile only, meaning they work out of their van and only meet customers at the job site. Investigator Jay Stedman, lead detective on the case, decided to do some real detective work and take the key to every locksmith in the city, just on the off chance they might recognize it as one of theirs. While the code AA14 means nothing to investigators or anyone else, it can be a world of information to a locksmith, especially in combination with the cuts on the key itself. Investigator Stedman hits pay dirt when he visits the locksmith shop on John B. White Sr. Boulevard. They recognize the blind code of AA14 immediately.
So yeah, I've said it before that, you know, you can tell some things about people by looking at their keychain and how they carry their keys and how their stuff is organized. People have, you know, goofy keychains with sayings on them or places that they've been on trips. You know, it's all sort of part of operational security. I feel like people that, you know, if their keys are disorganized, then they're probably disorganized. If the keys are in order and nice and tidy, that the rest of their life is kind of that way. You know, a key stamped AA14 could be any of a thousand different things. And if you were, you know, being that it's a super common keyway, that would take some narrowing down. You know, if after you work on systems for a while, you could probably figure out the pattern of the bidding, try to determine the master key and search through your systems like that. It wouldn't take 5 minutes, but it could probably take a day and we could figure it out. You know, if it's a weird keyway, it's going to be a lot easier.
So two things. Jay Stedman was a brilliant investigator because the things that are marked or stamped on keys are inconsequential to 99% of the people out there. But they can reveal a lot of information, and I won't bore you with the details. So kudos to him for thinking, hey, this was probably made by a locksmith. Let me seek them out and see if they can reveal a little bit more than just a key stamped AA14. What's impressive here, though, is that as standard as it may be, the locksmith knew that it belonged to him or her. And as Tim hinted in the narration, if I've got something stamped AA14 and I decode it, the chances that AA14 would correspond to a particular cut are just astronomical. It'd be like winning the lottery. So you can really determine, never mind how it may be stamped, hand stamped, pneumatic, whatever it may be, the size, the character set, whatever it may be. You hit on those two, you're certain. Now, my company and I, we're the outliers, but based on markings, if you were to bring me one of our keys, I can tell you who ordered it, when they ordered it, and everything it's ever worked, past or present. But we're the exception because this is our bread and butter. This is how we do everything. 99% of locksmiths don't operate that way. They generate a system, and then the next call, they go work on a car, or they go open a safe, or they go work on an exit device. Whereas I and my company, we're only paying attention to master key systems, things like that. But again, I mean, what Tim hinted at in this narration, that a locksmith recognized it and then compared it to what they had on record, it's just like lightning striking twice. And it's just the most positive affirmation, confirmation you could possibly get. And I just cannot believe that Jay had the foresight to seek out locksmiths and then, number one, find one that did it. You know, they just got so lucky here. But that's how this case has been so far. They've caught break after break after break. This is the second break so far.
For some of our listeners, that are not locksmiths, that don't know some of the terminology that we're talking about, a blind code is something that we stamp on a key. It's AA14, it could be BK23, it could be whatever letter number combination. And the reason why we do that is so that if somebody drops their key or sets their keys out, no one person who is completely unfamiliar with that individual can look at their keys and say, oh, this is a master key to the whole building, or this goes to apartment 215. It's the same reason why we don't stamp the word master on keys, because if you drop that key, if you misplace your keys, say just outside the building that you work in, and somebody comes along and picks up your ring of keys and sees, oh, this one's stamped master, and then they go try it in the door, and well, by golly, it opens every door in the place, then you're in real trouble. So we stamp them with a code that doesn't mean anything to a random person, but it does mean a lot to us. Also, the specifications for the key that are set by the manufacturer, basically what that refers to are the cuts in the key, the ups and downs, peaks and valleys, however you refer to them, those all mean something to us, and they are within thousandths of an inch of each other, and that distance between each other can tell us as locksmiths exactly what that key is supposed to be coded to. It's basically our way of decoding a key. So there's a lot of information for us out there.
Basically, these keys are like Rosetta Stones to us. We can figure out a lot once we have that.
To the friends and family of Tamika Houston, as well as members of the public, not much progress is visible. That's because investigators have to withhold certain details of the crime in order to protect the integrity of a case, preventing the perp from getting out of the charge in court, despite all evidence to the contrary. Tamika's aunt, Rebecca Howard, has struggled to keep the media's attention on her disappearance. 3 months after Tamika last spoke with family, Project Jason, an organization that provides support to families of missing persons, gets involved. On Saturday, February 19, 2005, the Greenville News publishes the headline, "Foul Play Now Suspected in Disappearance." Captain Randy Hardy reveals only that forensic evidence was found a month prior that clearly shows Tamika simply did not walk away from her life. With the help of the locksmith who made the key, detectives were able to go to the Fremont School apartments. They tried the AA14 key in every single lock of the building on Magnolia Street. Finally, they tried the key in a basement apartment that had been closed for some months due to flooding. When the key turned, police were relieved. Unfortunately, that apartment unit had been closed for some time due to flooding problems. After speaking with the manager of the complex, detectives learned that when a tenant moves out or is evicted, the property maintenance workers will switch the door hardware from that unit to another in order to prevent the former occupant from returning. But maintenance workers didn't keep records on which locks were moved from door to door.
So I'll start by saying that this is a terrible way to maintain security. You know, moving stuff around, trying to scramble things. The keys that work them are still out there. But it's highly unlikely, truthfully, that someone is ever going to try their previous key on every door at this apartment complex until they find the right one. And, you know, that's how the property owners justify how they do things the way they do it. I certainly never would, and I'm not blaming the locksmith here because he or she was likely only hired to put this complex on a master key system, and to save costs, it's just cheaper to move the locks around in lieu of paying that locksmith to come back out every time there's an eviction, a move out, whatever it may be. So it's not the locksmith's fault. Now here's the importance of record keeping. Even if you're just moving locks between units, at least you have a record so long as you write that down, which apparently in this case could have helped solve a murder, although I guess it kind of helped indiscriminately or unrelated, but it could also help solve any other crime, you know, property theft, sexual assault, whatever it may be. But here's the thing. Maintaining records is like balancing a checkbook or setting a budget. First of all, it takes work. And if you're lazy, you don't have time for all of that. Second, if you're not always diligent, it'll fall apart in short order. Trust me, I know this because I deal with property managers and chief engineers that don't follow along with our system. Things get out of hand real quick. I'm sending keys 3 or 4 times to try to make things work. Even if they weren't diligent, they're likely to have been able to piece together this somehow through a lot of different ways. Even something as simple as putting the key code on the lease agreement or, you know, having the customer sign off for the keys. At least you could attach a name to a unit or a person and go that way. But unfortunately, that's just the nature of the world today. People are lazy, whether it's professionally or unprofessionally. And apparently that was the case back in 2004.
Yeah, I mean, like, yes, like Tyler's, I mean, I've seen him seen the amount of records that Tyler keeps. It's very important to not just have the data, but have correct data. You know, sometimes we might go back to a system 15 years later and have to verify that what's actually, what our stuff says is actually still in use. You know, the place that you service every week, you're going to have a good idea. If it's something that you don't do often, you know, you need to verify before you send keys out. And I've had that happen where somebody moved something, didn't tell anybody, and tell me which key fits this, or do any of your keys go in there? So, you know, doing a little bit of legwork is important. Shipping is expensive, your time is worth something. And I think that, again, you know, these, it almost seems like the Keystone Cops, you know, they're getting they keep getting breaks. And not to discount what they've done, but it seems like parts of it have fallen into their lap.
I know that it's frustrating to the public when there's a investigation that has made the news, that's made it into the papers on the 5 o'clock news. It's all over social media these days, and law enforcement doesn't release any details. And unfortunately, people's interest is not held when there's no new information. The reason why officers can't reveal what they're learning in real time is because it protects the integrity of the case. I mean, after all, if you had, say you had a criminal who was out there on camera committing a crime, and as police tracked this person through, they posted their every move to social media. Now, that would alert the suspect, and they and their accomplices could disappear. Or by the time that the case is taken to court, the defense attorney can say, look, the police did this, they did that, they did that. The jury is tainted, and the case gets thrown out even though it's on camera. So although it's very frustrating for a lot of people and the media to not get constant updates from law enforcement officers, it is very, very important to keep certain details to themselves, because otherwise you don't want somebody to confess to something they didn't do, and you want to be able to find the right person when they say something that nobody outside of the investigation should know.
On March 3rd, 2005, an episode of America's Most Wanted airs featuring Tamika and offers a $20,000 reward for information that will solve her case. Managers of the income-based Fremont School Apartments gave officers a list of tenants from the time Tamika went missing. Investigators then sat down with family and friends of Tamika and asked them if any of the names were familiar. A friend recognized the name of Christopher Hampton. Using records from management, detectives went to apartment 215, nearly a year after Tamika disappeared. After using the AA building master key to unlock the Schlage Elan-style lever, they soon discovered bleach stains on the carpet in the bedroom. After pulling up the carpet, they found human blood. DNA tests soon proved that the blood was Tamika's. Investigator Stedman and his colleagues track down Christopher Hampton and find out that he is in prison for a parole violation, unrelated to their case. After confronting Hampton with the DNA evidence, he stands up and says, "Let's go." When the officers asked him where they were going, Hampton said he was going to take them to Tamika. A short time later, as investigators drove down South Carolina State Road 290 in Duncan, Hampton told them to turn onto Tiger River Drive. A short distance later, he said to stop and get out. From there, Hampton led officers down into a wooded area where, just over a year prior, he had buried Tamika's body. Hampton was so sure of the exact location because he had taken some large tree limbs and placed them over her shallow grave in the shape of a cross. The skeletal remains found were sent to the medical examiner's office, where they were confirmed to be Tamika Antoinette Houston.
So yeah, it's pretty I would say it's pretty rare that when somebody is arrested that they just take you to where the crime happened and basically confess to it. You know, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a police officer, but I'm guessing that that doesn't happen too often. You know, so once again, this is falling in their lap. Somebody was able to identify the guy. Somebody, you know, they found that he was in jail, so he wasn't out on the street. They didn't have to chase him down. And he offered up easily to take them to where it happened. I mean, it's almost like he wanted to get caught.
So suspects who never confess normally are those with extreme narcissism. They don't believe that they did it, even if they are shown a video of them committing the crime. Now, lots of times, suspects, especially in murder cases, will confess to either brag to investigators, such as serial killers, gang members bragging to other gang members about what they did. But a lot of times, these suspects in these crimes just confess to get the weight off their chest. I mean, Hampton's been literally walking around with his head, you know, looking over his shoulder hour by hour, day by day for a year. That amount of paranoia and suspicion, and every time you see a police officer just driving past you while you're walking down the street or in and out of the store thinking, are they here to get me? So he's given this opportunity when confronted by the evidence, and that is evidence that police officers would never have found had they not found the keys that he dropped in the front floorboard of Tamika's car, had the locksmith not recognized that blind code on there, and had they not done some real detective work.
Yeah, so no less than three things could have not panned out over the course of this investigation to have solved it. And I'm not saying that the investigators were not competent. They were, but they caught some awfully good breaks along the way. And I don't know if their competency and these breaks could have ever solved it alone, but paired together, here we are. We've got a suspect. We've got somebody that's admitting to it. I'm liking their chances.
April 2006. In a Spartanburg County courtroom, Seventh Circuit solicitor Trey Gowdy had his opening arguments prepared as he awaited Judge John Few to begin proceedings against Christopher Lamont Hampton. The case was solid with a confession and DNA evidence, plus the defendant's own keys having been found in the victim's car. It was open and shut. But before Gowdy had a chance to grace the courtroom with his passionate flair, Hampton's lawyer asked Judge Few to change his client's plea to guilty. Hampton was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Without the knowledge of a local locksmith recognizing their stamping of the code AA14, along with the cuts of the key, Tamika's disappearance might have never been solved. WYFF reporter Chris Cato stated that the detectives on this case must have wanted to give that locksmith a big kiss when he told them he recognized that key. Through a combination of local and national publicity, local locksmith knowledge, and good detective work, Tamika's case had been solved. On the cold, windy, first Saturday of November, 2005, Tamika Houston was given a final and proper funeral service at St. Michael Ethiopian Orthodox Church in Washington, D.C.
Executive producer is Tyler J. Thomas. Technical producer is Jeff Moss. Writer and editor is Tim Coleman.
For source material, see our website, 3tumblrs.com. Get this episode and others wherever you get your podcasts.
This has been a 3 Tumblrs production. Copyright 2024, all rights reserved.